You're listening to Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. This episode, Cavalier Oblique. So what did you do last week?
I worked a lot. I seem to have been out of the house far too much. And I'm taking a welding class, which is kind of awesome. At the place where I have my shop, they do classes as well. And so I'm learning to weld.
Cool. What kind of welding?
MIG welding right now.
Cool. I've always wanted to learn how to weld. I've done it a few times, but I've not taken a formal class on it. It's a lot of fun. I mean, you're using fire to meld two pieces of metal, and that is pretty fucking awesome.
In this case, electricity.
Yeah, even better. I mean, how cool is that? So that's pretty impressive.
Well, what were you up to last week?
I did fuck all last week, actually.
All right, good night.
and that's a wrap. Good night, everyone. I wound up working quite a bit on one of the projects that I can't really talk about. I'm quite happy with the results, and hopefully by the end of this year, we'll ship the app and life will be groovy. Other than that, I wound up seeing Hunger Games, which I thought was really quite cool. I was really impressed by it. So, right on. So guess what?
Hey, who's that guy?
Oh, today we have actually in our studio, or actually in his house. there we go. Hey, it could be a studio. They don't know. What? Don't judge. Today we've got Tim Kaine, who's been in the game industry for over 30 years. My goodness. And you probably recognize him for being the father of the hit game Fallout. So welcome, Tim.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
That is what a lot of people know me as the one who, that guy who made Fallout.
But you've done so much more stuff, which is pretty impressive as well.
I think fans kind of focus on what they like.
Right. I noticed that a lot of the stuff that you did was primarily RPG-based. There's Fallout. There was also the vampire-based game that you did as well.
Yeah, Bloodlines.
Are you just primarily interested in RPGs, or is it just that just happened to be the things that fell into your lap?
Well, I was primarily interested in playing RPGs and making them in the second company I worked for, because I actually worked at a smaller company in Virginia. But the first big company I worked for out here in California was known for making RPGs. And so that's kind of what I fell into doing.
You have noted influences on pen and paper RPGs as well. So did you play a lot of that?
Oh, yeah, I played a lot of RPGs. In fact, I like to tell people that my mother got me into playing D&D.
Really? So oh, what's that about?
Well, my mother worked for the Judge Advocate General's office in D.C. Mm-hmm. and in the Navy. And she came home one day and said that the boys in the office, and by boys, she meant guys in their 30s who might be, one was an admiral, they liked to play D&D. And she said, "You want to play?" And I said, "Sure." And so we went over to somebody's house on the weekend, and they taught me how to play D&D. We made a character. My mom played with us.
Wow.
Which is kind of strange.
A little weird, but also very, very cool, you know, very progressive.
Yeah, but I really got into it, and I think I thanked Gary Gygax in the manual on one of my first games, and I met him at a convention up in LA, and it was just really nice. He really got me into this industry.
I actually got into D&D at a fairly young age as well. I found a copy of the original red box Dungeons and Dragons, but it was the basic set. I found it in my father's closet. And wow. Normally that isn't what you find in your parents' closet when you look for things. But
your parents.
I forget why I was digging through their stuff. I found this red box and you know, it had this fantastic cover with the dragon and the warrior with the shield and the sword, and I completely fell in love with the idea of the game. It was all your imagination, and you were creating a story based upon that.
I think that's what attracted me to it, because unlike other games, it really had no boundaries. You know, you could do anything you want. You could make up anything you wanted. I just thought that was amazingly open-ended, and it attracted me too. But I was 13 when I got into D&D.
Did you ever wind up playing with your peer group? Did you bring it to your peer group? How did that work?
After I learned how to play, it's a big jump from playing it to running a game. So I got the books and I read through them, and I found, I found four friends, one of whom didn't have the stamina for the game and dropped out pretty quickly. But we started playing regularly, and we played all throughout high school, pretty much ninth grade through our senior year. We just played probably every Saturday. It was wonderful. It was a great learning experience too, because when I actually started making games, I realized that running so many games taught me a lot about what it would take to make a good game that would keep people interested and have a good storyline and just that, all the things that you usually learn on the job. I think D&D taught me how to do that years before I ever even thought about making a game.
Wow. Oh, damn it. That's where I screwed up.
Well,
I didn't play.
Oh,
I was always interested in I had some of the books. I was always interested in the mechanics of it and the, like you said, the open-ended ends of it. And I wasn't really a big, huge fantasy reader at the time. I was more into hard sci-fi, but I read Roger Zelazny and stuff like that. So I would sit there and read about how to make the game. I never really played with my friends, though. So I guess that's where I screwed up, or I could have been a game designer.
I actually had a similar experience it's sort of a hybrid experience between the both of you. I found it very difficult to keep a campaign running, and that kind of bummed me out. I wound up creating these campaigns with ready-made characters that people could just drop into. It was far easier to just give someone a piece of paper and say, okay, we're gonna play a story tonight, you know, and maybe it would continue the following week, or maybe it wouldn't, but instead of taking 5 hours to create a character, you could just jump everyone into it. I love the house rules. I would roll with a d20. Nowadays, with the modern edition of D&D, I think everything is d20 based.
Yeah. They got rid of most of the other dice.
Actually, I stopped playing beyond the second edition rules.
Yeah, I think I've played all of them. I think the first edition rules were just closest to my heart because they're the ones I learned on. Second seemed like they really had a bloating issue with lots of rules. And then the third came along and simplified everything. But then very quickly, they revised it all into 3.5. And then when 4 came out, 4 seemed to be their reaction to lots of computer games stealing the demographic from them of the people who would have gotten into D&D or instead playing online. And so they made it very much like the online gaming experience. And I thought that was a little unusual.
They wound up creating a system very, very similar to World of Warcraft, mm-hmm. where you have, you know, you've got these monsters, you know, the enemy, right? And then you have these fairly standard role procedure, right? So you've got the tank, and his job is to be really annoying. So annoying that the monster ignores everyone else trying to kill him, you know?
Yes.
And it was like, really? Because, I mean, part of the great thing about D&D was that every monster, because it was puppeted by the dungeon master, could do anything it wanted. And now you were sort of putting rules onto what the monster could or could not do, which just seemed very strange to me.
I had a lot of friends who really liked it, but many of them have dropped back to 3 or 3.5, or even the Pathfinder edition, which is kind of another offshoot of D&D. It's really fractured the market in my mind, because it's hard to find a group who still want to play that way, and if they do, who could agree on what rule set they want to play.
Because you figure with the advent of the iPad and all these electronic gizmos and such, that pen and paper gaming or role-playing games or storytelling type games would have a massive resurgence, just because all of the manuals are with you all the time. Mm-hmm. Not to mention the ability to... Now, granted, you know, rolling a bunch of dice in your hand is a lovely thing, and it's a very tactile, very emotional response there. But at the same time, managing your character sheet digitally is so much easier.
I've heard of people doing something with Microsoft's Surface table where they actually had characters that were on the tabletop and could be moved around and sensed by the table, and you had your abilities next to him, it would keep track of your hit points and what different abilities were available to you in any particular round and whose turn it was. And it was really cool that it took over those drudgery aspects of the game. It becomes a tiny step, though, to just take that last step and just play WoW or another online MMO.
Your imagination is so much more powerful than the fastest NVIDIA card known to man. I can certainly see why people play online role-playing games, but at the same time, it's a very different experience. The whole idea of D&D and the fracturing is somewhat intriguing to me. And didn't they also technically open source the game mechanics?
Yeah, when they went to D20, they open sourced it, so you can make pretty much anything you want using the quote D20 rules, which people have made a bunch of different types of games and different genres, sci-fi games and all kinds of stuff like that. It's just, I still think that there's groups of people who stick to third edition or even second edition. I still have a pristine set of, I think, third edition rules that I bought and three and a half came out, so suddenly that I just put the third edition away. But I'm not really playing much anymore, and I think it's just too easy to play online games with your friends than to try to get everybody together on a Saturday.
With the pen and paper stuff, it's a much more slow pace. I still think that being in a room together is going to have a bigger impact with regard to the storytelling, with regard to the amount of fun that you're going to have playing these games. With a graphical game, everyone's seeing exactly the same thing, and it's just easier to pick up.
Yeah. It also at least mimics some of the social aspects of getting together with all your friends, and it makes it easy if someone has to duck out. You know, you don't have to stop playing for the night. At the same time, I still kind of miss when me and like three or four friends would get together around, you know, the dining room table and play some game for 6 or 7 hours. There's something I miss about that, that a game like WoW doesn't bring me. But since WoW lowers the barrier to entry from in almost every other way, we're pretty much left playing online games like that.
The most recent versions of WoW, and this is sort of why I stopped, the barrier of entry has in fact hit rock bottom. With the exception of, you know, the need to pay a monthly fee. But even then, there are so many free-to-play games out there that, mm-hmm. you know, you can get your RPG fix, put it on any machine you want, and pretty much get something of quality, which is great for people who are into gaming or want to try it out. I started playing WoW late, actually. I played about three or four weeks prior to the first expansion coming out.
Wow.
Yeah. Because I knew so many people who played it pretty much from the get-go. I don't know, a lot of the fun has been knocked out of it. I think that has a lot to do with how the game has evolved over time. You know, their quest to get ever more subscriptions and also to appeal to the PvPers versus the PvEers. So the player versus player versus the player versus environment. Yeah. Schism.
Yeah, I agree. I started playing WoW in 2005, but I stopped playing it over a year ago. And mostly because you do, any game will wear thin over time. But for me, the raids in that game had just become sort of really advanced, complicated choreography. Literally choreography. It's like, you have to stand here.
Right.
When he turns his head this way, everybody take 10 steps to the left.
Yeah, everyone
does. And then you throw this. Yeah. And it's and these people move forward, these people move back, these people rotate. It's just, it became so, it was like an elaborate dance move. And at that point, I was like, what happened to exploration and storyline and things like that? That's just, it's gone. It's all have to do with raids and item acquisition and
right,
things like that.
Well, WoW has always been based on Vegas rules, right? And I think a lot of the MMORPGs are like that as well, which is, you know, they want to keep you subscribed. So they set up a universe in which, you know, if you play for 10 more minutes, you'll get another cookie. And
yeah.
And that's constant, right? So, oh, I'll just play for one more hour so I get, you know, 100 more gold, or I'll just play for another 15 minutes because I'll be able to complete this quest and kick a level. There's always some excuse to continue playing and therefore continue your subscription. And that just gets to be a grind. I mean, aside from killing a million rats or whatever, you know, that you've got to do early on. But
we talk a lot about, though, these games are designed with the carrot and stick model.
Sure.
Where there's two ways to get, you know, the donkey moving. You can dangle a carrot in front of it, you can hit it with a stick. Some of the early MMOs like UO and EverQuest, they used a lot of sticks. they basically punished you severely if you did something badly. You could lose your, you know, if you died, you could lose things off your body. You could lose items you've tried to get. You could even sometimes lose your body. I mean, I know people who died in EverQuest and they asked, quote, a friend to help grab their corpse, and the person dragged their body into lava and just left it there. Oops. And it's impossible for you to get it. What they did, I think, brilliantly in WoW was they got rid of almost every stick. It's a game of all carrots.
Right.
And that really, I mean, you don't really notice it at first, but there are no cursed items. There's really no negative repercussion. Death has a really minor penalty. It's just a lot of carrots. Almost everything you do, oh, just kill that one more group and it may drop this item you want. Or, hey, if you just kill a few more things or do a few more quests, you're going to go up a level and then you get these really cool abilities. The game is just full of so many carrots, especially when they added achievements, that it almost fulfills that... there's a psychological reward model. It's that pure randomness.
Yeah, it's that endorphin rush. Every time the bell rings in your head, every time you get a new thing, you get that squirt of endorphins. that keeps you playing. And that's why kids in school were playing this and failing all their classes. because it was, you know, the all carrot model. Precisely that. You know, when you died in WoW, the biggest penalty was having to walk to your corpse. No one could take anything from it. Can't die permanently. As a matter of fact, you don't even have to get your corpse. You could, in fact, just resurrect right then and there. You'd have a bit of a penalty for doing that. They called it resurrection sickness, so you were quite vulnerable. But if you were on a server that wasn't a PvP server, so you weren't necessarily going to be attacked by the opposing faction of other people playing, it just didn't matter. And so you just kept playing. Yeah, I actually forgot that, because everyone has pretty much adopted the WoW model because it's so successful, I forgot that the earlier MMORPGs had the death is a thing. You know, you can be corpse looted, you can be permanently killed. It was just absolutely wild. And to think about that, you know, especially if you're a subscriber, the idea that this thing that you've worked so hard for, that if you're paying, you know, $10 a month or what have you, and you've been playing for years, you know, you've plopped in several $100s into this game, and to think that someone could just steal something you've worked so hard for, you know, it's quite daunting.
But the flip side of that is, yes, WoW has filed off all those sharp edges, but I think in getting rid of the low lows, they've gotten rid of some of the high highs.
Right.
The game is much less about ups and downs, and I think that's a bit of a loss, but if you never played any of those earlier games, you're never really miss it.
You suffered through the pain and anguish that was Ultima Online, and, you know, and not to say that they weren't good games, they were good games, but again, the penalties, like you said, the sticks were many. And so, you know, you've kind of pulled through that and you've survived. Maybe it's a bit of post-traumatic stress syndrome, but it is one of those things where now that WoW has evolved to be this very smooth, very soft game where nothing bad really happens. And as a matter of fact, they kept on breaking down the barriers and breaking down the barriers that now they're attempting to, anyway, completely get rid of the random number generator. It used to be you would have to kill the bad guy a jillion times before the shiny thing that you wanted would drop. And now it's, I believe in the upcoming version, I read somewhere, you just roll and the top four people get what they want.
Wow, I didn't know about that. I thought they were going to the, like, tokens, what do they do now, which is every time you kill the monster, you get a token.
Right.
And that way, if the thing you want doesn't drop, eventually you can just buy it with these tokens.
Yeah, you were able to do that in the current game, but then the new one that's coming out very soon, yeah, they're going to this thing where it's just, okay, well, everyone in the raid rolls, and the top four or the top five people get the most appropriate item for your class.
So don't they still have the randomness? Because you have to win that roll, right?
Well, you have to win that roll, but if you win the roll, you win the roll.
You know you get something good.
And you know, well, it's not even get something good. You know you'll get the thing that is most appropriate for you.
Yeah.
Which is also really weird because they introduced the idea of changing your spec. So if you were a warrior who has a role of being either DPS or being a tank, if you happen to be a tank, but that was just the off chance because the regular tank didn't show up that day, would you get a tank weapon or would you get a DPS weapon? You know, or would you not be allowed to get the DPS weapon? Because you don't get a choice of what you get. You get the thing that the algorithm says you're supposed to get.
Not to open my whole lunchbox all at once, but I think it's kind of interesting that some of the things you guys are talking about, your love for D&D and the books, and even some of the things you loved in these other games, kind of ties into, I think Fallout is still so popular in it, with the people who really love it. We were talking about the books and the richness of the storytelling and things like that. There was a lot of that you guys put into Fallout. I mean, the manual was full of all this stuff that people could sit and pore over and read, and it became something that they cared about, kind of just like you did with your D&D books. You know, you'd carry them around and open them at lunchtime and pore over the monsters and try to draw them and things like that. Mm-hmm. So the books, the manuals, in joke, I mean, it shows the people who are creating it. It shows their love for the genre as much as the people who are playing it love it. And I think that's that being part of the clan is really what makes this game so timeless.
We really did love making that game too. And one reason the manual is like it is we used to talk back then. This is, you know, the mid to late 90s. And this game came on a completely filled CD. It was almost 700 meg of data that if you did a full install. Yeah, I mean, it didn't sound like a lot now, but
I know. But
if you did a full install, that would take probably 30 minutes or more to copy to your hard drive. And I remember thinking that there was a, first of all, that's why we didn't have copy protection on that game, because I convinced them that nobody would ever be able to copy 700 meg of data. That's my Bill Gates 640K moment.
Right.
That's right. Awesome. But, yeah, but I imagine yours is a little more tongue-in-cheek.
Probably.
Well, but I mean, at the time, it's true.
Sure.
I didn't want to put DRM on the disk. But what really got us was we're like, what are they going to do during that time? So the game is sitting there spinning, and you're all excited because you brought home this game, and you can't play it for 30 minutes. And the lead designer, Chris Taylor, said, let's write a really awesome manual that actually looks like something you'd get if you were in that vault. It's like, hey, we're going to send you outside, you know, and you've been living in this vault for years. Here's an orientation manual. And that's why it's written in that humorous 60s style of, you know, you've lived in this vault, and here's what you have to look forward to, and here's what you need to be careful of. And it's just, it's a fun read because they were trying to make you feel better, even though you were probably going outside to your death.
The whole style of the game was fantastic. It exuded this rich environment that was set up very much like, you know, it had the propaganda of the 1950s Donna Reed, everything is fine if you duck and cover, you know. That was just
right.
Just absolutely.
The ads at the back.
Oh, yeah. Just absolutely mind-blowing. That
coping with Mr. Virus.
I love that if you get radiation, just take a shower.
Yeah.
Just wash it off.
Just wash it off, yeah. Silkwood, anyone?
Yes. But we had everything was like that. The box was, the lead artist wanted the box to look like a lunchbox that would actually exist in the world. The load screens, you know, looked like comic books that might take place in this world. Everything looked like something you'd find. And we just loved that, letting people pretend. The whole experience seemed to matter more back then. Where now, you know, you click on a game and it digitally downloads in a minute or two when you're in playing. There is no build-up that anybody really has anymore.
At the same time, I think you can make an analog to LPs versus MP3s. For our younger listeners, there used to be these things called LPs, and they were made of vinyl. They had gorgeous artwork, and you'd have gatefolds, and the artwork would be beautiful, and you'd have liner notes, and it was really incredible. And then CDs came out, and the artwork shrank. While the sound quality may have been better eventually, the size of the artwork was just less impressive. And now we're getting to digital download, and there's really no artwork whatsoever. You know, yeah, okay, it's a JPEG that's attached to the MP3 or whatever the file is, but it's really not the same as sitting home late at night, after you've gone to the record store, brought home a bunch of stuff, you take the album out of its sleeve, you put it on the turntable, you drop the needle, and you just listen. It's a much more immersive, engaging experience than this ultra-portable, almost implied multitasking use of music today with MP3s. You know, everyone's listening to music, but they're not paying attention to the music. It's something that goes on in the background for a large number of people. And I think that with Fallout, you really never broke that fourth wall, down to the packaging, down to all the swag that came with it, down to the game itself. It was all part of that, which allowed you to immerse yourself fully into this game.
I think, too, I had a lot of people. I just gave a talk at the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco, and then people come up afterwards to talk to me about how important the game was to them. These are the kind of things that I'm not surprised hearing this anymore, but after Fallout came out, when people were saying, wow, this game like changed my life, I didn't know how to react to that. You know, what do you do when somebody say, well, I based my life on the teachings of Fallout? You know, I'm like, good.
That was one of the fantastic things about the game itself. It was basically entirely open-ended. You could do anything you wanted. You could slaughter people wholesale, but there was always a consequence for the action.
Right. And actually, to bring it back to the D&D discussion, mm-hmm. or just to pull that in, what I learned of years of playing D&D, well, my friends, we all tried different turns of being the dungeon master, and eventually I ended up doing most of it. And part of it was I learned that if you try too much to lead people down a story, they won't do it. And some of our best adventures were me just providing a scenario and seeing what they did, and I reacted to them. And so we tried to code the game so that it could react to different ways you could respond to just scenarios. I tell the quest designers, just come up with the scenario, and then let's see how we play it. And then let's have the game react to common ways we're seeing people playing it. So we had a lot of back and forth with the QA department. They would come over and tell us things they were doing. And we would just go, okay, well, we'll have the game, you know, track that. And then if you do that a lot, either people will think differently of, you know, different groups in the game will have different reactions to you, or we'll put an end slide. That's where that idea came from. To tell people, well, because you treated this group so poorly, at the end of the game, a slide comes up saying, you know, they're destroyed now. You attack them so much that they're scattered to the wind. People would feel guilty about that. And then they'd replay the game and try to be nicer people. It's sad that you have to learn that lesson, but that's what people would come up to me and say is, I learned that everything has a consequence to what I do, and I apply that to my daily life now. That's wonderful to hear.
Yeah, it's really kind of amazing
to see people, to hear people say, you know, be upset when they have done something that causes a bad consequence in the game, and to go back and try to do it a better way. It's kind of amazing. Added to all, you guys had a lot of, it was a critical look at society in a way. I think you mentioned in another interview I've seen, you know, that yeah, maybe it's kind of over the top, and this is not, you know, it's the world that's really going to happen. But it is a commentary on human nature in a lot of ways in the game. I think that's really, really cool.
We were surprised. The most liked character in Fallout was the dog, who had absolutely no dialogue, had a very simple script. He just, if you wore the Mad Max leather jacket, which looks just like the jacket, we patterned it after the leather jacket that Mel Gibson wears in Rogue Warrior, or you give him a piece of food, he will just follow you around for the rest of the game. And he never talks. He can't do things. He can't open doors. All he does is, if you attack something, he'll attack it too. And people fell in love with that dog.
Who doesn't love doggies?
It's true. People would replay.
I love that dog.
They would replay the game, or they would get upset if the dog died, and they'd go back to the last save game and find a way of keeping the dog alive.
I think, again, that's a testament to that immersive experience where, you know, yeah, technically these are just, you know, some scripts and some pixels on the screen, but you've evolved these characters so that people are engaged in them. You know, they do, in fact, care. They really want to see what they can do to make it better, you know, to have that idea of the, quote, best ending, or at least an alternative ending to see, well, what are the possibilities?
Well, there's a lot of combinations with them. And one thing that we always stressed too was, for any given scenario, we always made sure that you could fight your way through it, sneak your way through it, or talk your way through it. But not every scenario had one of those as the best way to do it. So like, if you were always just fighting things, you'd run into scenarios where that's like the worst thing you could possibly do is try to fight your way through it. That would lead to the worst end slide. So if you just played the game one way, that was the other thing we were trying to show people. It's like, there is no one best solution to all life's problems. Maybe you should stop and talk to people occasionally. Maybe you should just try to avoid them altogether. But sometimes you just have to, you know, fight. But not always. And not it's not always obvious which one is the best.
Maybe you should stop and see if they want to get a game of D&D going.
The Inception game. It's a game within a game. I wanted to talk a little about, you know, we talked about Fallout, and Fallout was originally a fairly small team, if I recall correctly.
It was just me for about 6 months. I started Airplane when there was only 40 employees. I was in 92. When I left in 98, there were 500 or 600 employees, so it really grew. But
wow.
At one point, I was doing a lot of installers for other games. I was doing sound code, critical error handling. And even though I would do them on different games, I really had made fairly generic modules to handle this. So in my spare time, I was making my own game engine. You know, at the work, but it was fun. Sure. And And I would show it to some of the people, you know, producers. And eventually we started making a game with it. It was never planned. It was never budgeted. It just happened. I like to think of Fallout. Fallout was a bit of lightning in a bottle. And I'm not sure that would ever happen again. Because of that, it kind of grew organically. More and more people came on. Just as we needed people, and they came off of their projects, they would come on board to Fallout. So by the time we were done, it took us 3.5 years. In the last 6 months, we probably had more than 30 people working on it, which was big for them.
Right. But that's changed, you know, versus today, where you may have several hundred people working on it, which is kind of mind-blowing, I think.
The MMO I was working on at Carbine, there were 40 people just in my department, and there were 130 people on the game.
Budgets for these games have grown exponentially as well. You know, it's almost, I mean, quite literally, they're blockbuster film budgets.
And the companies and the teams, they look more like a film studio in a way, too. The size and the things that, you know, the way they're laid out. It's kind of interesting to me to see that change, especially, like Christopher said, the budgets are just so big.
Well, I think it was 5 years ago that the game industry passed the movie industry, I think, in total revenue.
Yeah.
Something we should point out to the NBAA when they scream about how much money our economy is losing. They're not as big as they think they are.
It's interesting because now the game designers seem to have roles that are very similar to those in cinema. You know, you've got sound designers, people who are doing character art versus world art. You've got directors, producers, etc., etc. It's very, very similar in a lot of regard, and that's also interesting to me. And I guess part of that is due to the fact that the graphics cards and such are now so sophisticated, whereas before, you know, the resources were significantly constrained. You may have had lofty ideals, and you know, certainly a lot of people pulled a lot of rabbits out of a lot of hats in order to be able to create a lot of these games. But now it's at it's just a completely different level.
There's a lot more specialization now. I know programmers that just do graphics or just do network code, and they really don't know much else about the rest of the game. They have very narrow scopes. And same thing for the artists. I knew an artist who, I think she worked at Square, and all she did is make chairs.
Wow. That is very specialized. Yeah. I was going to say, well, if it was a Square game, I can imagine, you know, there was someone who just specializes in hair.
Yeah. People do faces. Some people model, while other people animate. Other people rig, which is actually putting the bones in so that the animator can then make things animate. So there's really highly specialized work that people do in all of the main departments in making a game.
There was a similar thing in the post-production universe as well. So you've got people who are cutters, and they're basically only they only edit. You have the VFX guys who, you know, there are some that just do basic motion graphic. Well, I shouldn't say basic because that's wrong. They just do lower thirds. And then you have the people who do full-on 3D compositing. Then you have the rotoscopers. Then you have, you know, all these specialized fields, sort of subfields within the post-production universe. Now it's rather interesting because it seems to me that the post-production universe is actually shrinking a little bit. Even though the budgets for mainstream cinema have increased quite a bit, it seems to me that the visual effects budgets are also quite large, but they want more people to do more things at once. So it's not, you can't just be a cutter anymore. You have to also be able to have some ability to do a color grade or some ability to do some manipulation. People are wearing multiple hats now, whereas that used to be very much delineated according to very, very small, narrow roles. And it seems to me that the game space has swapped with that.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought the movie industry was fairly unionized.
Oh, it is. It's very, very much unionized. But there's also a shadow industry where there's a lot of independent editors and independent VFX folk out there. What happens is they get hired by these post-production houses to basically be bodies. Again,
disposable bodies.
Well, and that's part of the problem. You know, they're basically hired at slightly above minimum wage to do VFX work that is going to be seen in the cinema, and the film has a budget of, you know, $100 million or something like that. And meanwhile, they're getting paid slightly above minimum wage because it's so competitive that if they want more money, well, they just won't won't hire you, and they'll hire some kid who is willing to work for free because they want the credit on the film.
Yeah, this is a really, really contentious thing that's going on in the film industry, Tim. I don't know if you've heard any about it. These people get treated pretty poorly because the whole idea is to try to keep VFX houses from gaining a foothold, to try to keep these people from unionizing because they can use them as this disposable labor. There was recently an issue where a particular film, which I think they've made mostly amends now, ended up not paying a lot of people, just not paying them. The movie made money, but I'm sorry, I know we're kind of going down a rabbit hole, but...
Oh no, I didn't know any of this was going on.
Yeah, it's... That section of the industry is not unionized. Some of them are trying very hard, but it's really tough.
It's tough when your competition is a college student who's willing to work for free.
Right, and those people are the ones that are, you know, they can do a little bit of everything.
Yeah, I think, at least in computer games, I think the reason it's becoming more and more specialized is the, like you said, the hardware is becoming more advanced, and that's true for audio hardware as well. And you really can't do that. You can't hire someone unless they have a few years of experience with it. It's hard to just know. Actually, there's very few programmers I run into that can do the networking code required for something like, you know, World of Warcraft. I think in that sense, you have a little bit of job security just because once you acquire some knowledge in that area, you can pretty much work. Any, you know, you can if a company treated you poorly, you just walk and go somewhere else.
I think in the film industry, some of that's gone. I mean, there was a point way back when, you know, where camera technicians, for instance, were like gold. But these days, it's not the same. So I guess that's kind of where they diverge too. And like you say, you're working on discrete pieces of a thing that's connected, but it's connected in such a way that it's modular. Whereas in general, the film industry, lots of things have to tie to each other. You know, they're kind of rigged in a way.
The analog, I think, is the indie VFX folk are the equivalent of game testers. They're working 80 billion hour weeks for no money, for hopefully a chance to either, you know, get a leg up into, you know, one of the bigger houses, or they move up the ladder a bit. It winds up just being very exploited labor in a lot of cases.
Yeah, and I think the game industry's, after a few notable lawsuits in that regard, has moved away from this expectation that people work 10, 12, 14 hours a day. And on weekends, they still do it. We still have, you know, some of the worst crunch times in any industry, but it's now not expected that you will do that for a long period of time and with no extra pay.
And that's great. I mean, you look at some of these game houses, and it's great. You can see that they are viable companies in their own right. Which, like I said, for a lot of VFX houses, I mean, when you see the orphanage closed, there's something wrong. I mean, and that's great for your industry. It's absolutely wonderful. And things like a writer is required. It is not an option anymore. You need a writer. So that, yeah. I think that's great.
What do you think the solution is in the VFX industry? What do you think the solution is going to be to that? I mean, is it just going to keep going on like this?
So far it has, unfortunately it's getting worse as well. It's not getting better.
My personal theory is that it will continue on until such time as the major studios become less important, in which time those people will become stakeholders in whatever project they're working on, apart from these giant studios producing. You know, as time goes on, those things, they will become less and less important to making a movie. I know budgets are huge, don't get me wrong. I believe in the meritocracy, and I think there will come a time. And I can, the game industry is a good example. You know, you look at these houses that they're working with large budgets, but they have some control over their destiny. They're seen as necessary.
What I've heard people say in the game industry, at least, is if you churn the milk enough, the cream rises to the top. If you have enough turmoil, eventually there's a group that will rise above that. I mean, hopefully that'll happen in VFX as well.
I think Maggie brings up a very interesting point, which is overall the larger studios are diminishing because the barrier of entry of creating a high quality cinema quality, you know, mainstream cinema quality film is so much lower than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, that we're going to see these more independent, smaller studios rise up, especially if we can get better distribution now that everything is digitally distributed versus, you know, having to cut 20,000 celluloid prints and then distribute them. I'm curious as to whether or not that will happen in game development. On one hand, you've got, you know, giant companies like EA, right? And on the other hand, you've got these small independent guys who they're starting to target handheld, like iOS, Android, and these games are much simpler. The app model is in its infancy right now, and so people are making these very casual, simple games, and they simply require less budget, fewer people. So I think that's also an interesting turn of events.
Yeah, what really drives that is since your CPU and screen space is more limited on mobile devices, it's kind of throwback to what games were like in the 80s and 90s. And with digital distribution, you don't need a publisher.
Right. So, yeah, because Apple acts as your publisher. You hit the go button and suddenly it's available to hundreds of millions of people, which is pretty wild.
Well, you don't have the cinema barricade either, which is kind of a problem in the movie industry. But for instance, like you're talking about, there's EA and then there's all these smaller publishers who can go and make a deal with someone like Best Buy and get their game in there.
Right.
Best Buy says, yeah, this game, it has a lot of buzz. We're going to sell it. Whether or not you're not a Paramount movies equivalent, doesn't matter. But from my perspective, I wouldn't say the playing field is level, but it's less of an incline.
It is. The thing that we're now talking about, a lot of people are talking about in the game industry, is something we're seeing happen with ebooks, is it's easier to get a game or an ebook out there, so more and more people are doing it. How do you make your stand out, and how do people find the good ones?
Right.
How many apps are in the internet?
Yeah, there are bajillions of apps out there. The App Store is incredibly difficult to use. Mm-hmm. It's a web interface. The searching's really bad. Browsing's really awful. It's just a really bad experience. And the only way to know about something that you may be interested in is word of mouth or advertising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or if you're somehow get on a top list with just top downloaded
right
games.
And that's one of those things where you have to have some insider knowledge. If you happen to know someone at Apple, then you can point them to that app, and if they dig it, then they can tell some other folk inside Apple, and then suddenly you're on an editor's pick list, and that pretty much guarantees tens of thousands of downloads.
But I wouldn't discount the word of mouth either. I mean, when you look at something like Plants vs. Zombie or even Angry Birds, I mean, Angry Birds is huge now, it's hard to look back on it, but it was just this lap at the time from nobody, and it did, like you say, it did rise to the top, so to speak, because of mostly word of mouth.
I mean, it's an incredibly easy to use game, and it's specifically targeting the casual gamer. It's the people who don't necessarily consider themselves gamers, but will pick up something, play with it for a few minutes, put it down, and then pick up. And you may not be exactly where you left off, but because there's no intense, engaging storyline, it's okay. You can put it down for several weeks and you don't feel lost when you pick it back up.
But what's interesting about that is they do tend to be simple games, but because they're also easy to code and there's so many of them on the App Store, I didn't realize most of the games that I've purchased are because either a friend of mine or a coworker said, oh, have you tried, you know, this app? It's really awesome. I bought my mom an iPad 2 so we could FaceTime, and she doesn't know what to buy. She goes to the App Store and she's completely lost. I'm her like only link to like what a good app would be.
Yeah,
it's hard. I don't know where that's going to go.
I never browse the store looking for stuff. It's always I go and look and see what people are doing.
And especially because the App Store does not allow you a trial. For me, it's all friend based. I see it, you know, on a website or something, and I see a review of it, and I was like, wow, that, you know, may be intriguing. So the marketing aspect, I think, is also really important to get your app in front of the reviewers on something like App Shopper or, you know, one of the review sites, so that you can see a little bit more screenshots than they usually have in the store itself. And sometimes you can get a video of them actually playing it, because that's the other thing that bothers me as well. You know, you may have a really great UI, but if it's slow and kind of janky and the actual user experience is bad because of that, then it's not worth it to me. I'd much rather have a UI that's maybe not as slick, but is fast, responsive, and engaging than something that's merely pretty.
I was surprised that the App Store doesn't have a genius element to it, where it's like, if you liked this game, here are, you know, three other games that are similar that you may like.
Right. And maybe this is around the corner and maybe it's not. Or Christopher liked this a lot, you know, and you would like this.
Yeah,
I think we see that on when games try to write to your Facebook account. I think that's what they're trying to do. You know, if I follow Chris on Facebook and three times a day I see him, Chris just unlocked such and such in this game. Well, I might be interested in going to try that game. Maybe.
I'm not sure how to get back to work.
Exactly. You're not supposed to know about the games I'm playing. But that, well, that's the other thing too. It's like everything tries so desperately to be social. Enough already. I'm personally getting social fatigue. You know, everyone, because I'm on Twitter a lot. When I start seeing what people are playing on iTunes in my Twitter feed, I don't care about that, you know, because they're doing it every 5 minutes and they're basically polluting my stream.
Yeah.
And that's
right.
Just...
But if you're 14, that means a lot to you. And that's kind of where it all breaks down. When you're not 14 anymore, Facebook doesn't work the same. There's a flip side to this, and it ties into the App Store as well. If it hadn't been for Facebook, I wouldn't have known that Trilobite was still around and they were about to republish The Seventh Guest on iOS, which is another cool thing that the App Store is doing. I'm starting to see a lot of retro games coming back. I'm a huge retro game fan. It's just amazing and awesome.
Baldur's Gate, which is an amazing RPG that came out in the late 90s, is being re-released for iOS.
Yeah, I saw that as well.
Amazing.
Oh, yeah. So much fun. Maggie, yeah, because you created a Robotron shrine / controller.
I love Robotron so much. I think I might have said that once or 30 times on this podcast.
Just a few. But yeah, I mean, just the idea of being so into it that you decided to make your own controller and all of that, I think that's brilliant. That gives rise to what I wanted to talk about, which was, aside from PC games, are you at all an arcade gamer as well?
I used to be, but I play a lot of console games. We have people go, what console do you have? And I'm like, all of them. We've got a Wii, a PS3, and an Xbox 360 set up, you know, in the living room, and they all get turned on regularly. What's the last game I played? Demon's Souls? Have you heard of that game?
Oh, that was the one that Robert was playing the other day.
Yeah, it's a sequel to Dark Souls.
Oh, right on. Yeah. I've heard of it. I haven't played it. We had a discussion with Kanan Flowers a few episodes ago where we talked about Borderlands, and
I love that game. Like,
yeah. See, haven't played it, and I now want to buy a console just to play that game.
They're about to come out with Borderlands 2.
I know. That's why I want to play it now. So I'm ready for Borderlands 2.
Well, and the game I'm working on, it's PC, Xbox 360, and PS3 same time. It's simultaneous development, and it's the first time I've done console development, especially simultaneous console development, which means every time I add code, I have to make sure it works on all three of those target platforms before I can check it in.
Wow.
It was approved.
Right.
And it kind of slows things down because all three of those are very different machines with different restrictions. What may work flawlessly on a PC may take too much memory on a PS3 or run too slowly on an Xbox 360. So
right, because they're radically different architectures as well. You know, the whole idea of the PS3 is really all about streaming, right? It's about it's got very little RAM in it. It's not computer like at all. I mean, like, you know, PC like at all, where, you know, you've got a bank of RAM and you've got, you know, lots of storage. This is really all about it's got a fairly minimal amount of RAM in it, but the idea is that you execute as fast as possible, massively parallel, and blit it to the screen, and basically get it out of RAM.
Right, have multiple CPUs and not a lot of RAM, which both of those create issues for how we code the game. And the other restriction is we want it to look identical in all three, and that's a tough bar to reach, and I think we're doing it, but it's an interesting thing because we've joking, like, wouldn't it be awesome to have this on, you know, an iPad or a Vita? We could do it, but I don't think we could make it look exactly the same as it does in the other platforms. And it'd be quite a challenge to do that.
Well, that's really interesting because that on one end, it's cool that it will look the same on all platforms, so no one gets short shrift. But at the same time, it also seems to be fairly limiting because, for example, if on the PS3, the shader pipeline is much more robust, so you can create better shadows, better lighting, better whatever. Wouldn't you want to exploit that versus having to dumb it down to the lowest common denominator. And it seems to me like way back in the day, in the console days where you had your Atari, your ColecoVision, your Intellivision and all that, you may have had a game that went out for all three platforms, but they looked radically different. And that was okay.
Yeah, I think part of it is the nature of this particular game because it's based on South Park, the TV show. So perhaps it's realistic to have that. We're trying to make it look like the TV show.
Sure.
So making it look like that on all those three platforms is doable. It's more of an issue of frame rate, fill rate, being able to keep everything in memory that we want to keep in memory because we don't want any hiccups to occur. You know, nobody likes looking at a load screen. I was impressed. A lot of what Bethesda does with Oblivion or Fallout 3 or Skyrim looks very similar in all three. And they do really high-end stuff. And they do a really good job. I mean, Fallout 3, I thought, looked pretty much the same on all three of those platforms.
My feeling is that today's console gamers and you have to throw PC gamers in there, they all expect that they're all going to get the same experience. Where, like Christopher was alluding to earlier, you know, it was like, well, but you should get a Dreamcast because, you know, well, God, I'm showing my age, because it looks so much better. Well, yeah, because Game X looks better on, you know, this because, you know, so it kind of drove the console, whereas now it seems like there's an expected democracy of gaming.
Yeah, I think there is. I think except for exclusive games, you know, and there aren't a whole lot of
right,
those.
Right.
Like Little Big Planet is exclusive to PS3. There's this expectation that if I buy this on another console, I don't want to feel like I missed out on something.
The onus gets put on the game creator.
That's actually what's becoming frustrating now is if you buy an online game on the Xbox and your friend buys it on the PS3, you can't play together for no other reason other than usually those manufacturers don't let you. You could, especially if you're keeping the server yourself, you could let those people play. And I'm very frustrated by that as a player.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, because I mean, for example, World of Warcraft and actually everything Blizzard has ever done has always been cross-platform and equal across the board. So Mac WoW people can play with the PC WoW people and no one knows that you're a dog. PlayStation and Xbox have radically different infrastructures with regard to their server component. You know, PlayStation for the longest time was saying, you're on your own, you got to do your own thing. Whereas Microsoft was, hey, we're going to provide this thing for you and people are going to subscribe to it, but you can pretty much guarantee a user base, which is kind of cool.
They had the consoles, they had the numbers to do it.
Oh, certainly.
At the time, yeah. But then, of course, Sony sees it, you know, so they create their own walled garden as well, you know, whether or not they can do it as well or not, which obviously, anyway.
But to Tim's point, if you have your own servers, from a user perspective, it seems to me that, well, if you're doing it on your own servers, then why can't I play with my mates on the PS3, you know, so
because we need them to buy Xboxes.
But that's not something that is a concern for a third party game developer.
There's like billing issues though. You know, how do I charge you your monthly fee? You have to make sure that at least the billing process is separate for those different games.
So is there a contractual restriction that prevents you from doing that? For example, if you're making a game for all the platforms like Xbox, PS3, must you use their networking infrastructure, or is there something preventing you from just doing your own server and just letting everyone, you know, use that instead?
You know, I've never actually done contracts with consoles. All my contracts at Troika were for PC. I suspect it is a contractual restriction. I've never seen anyone do it. I keep waiting for a big, powerful company like Valve to say, we're going to make this game and it's going to run on Xbox and PS3 and those people will be able to play together.
Right.
But we'll see what happens.
Because that's the rumor with Diablo 3 as well, which is, you know, obviously it's going to come out for Mac and PC, but there was also a rumor where it may be real by now. I haven't really kept up. It kept delaying it and delaying it and delaying it. And then I wound up playing, was it Torchlight?
Mm-hmm.
And then
that's a great game.
Oh my God, such a fantastic game.
I think the thing is though, because Blizzard's making it, you know, it's going to be intensely well crafted.
Oh yes. I've seen the gameplay and I've seen the screenshots and I didn't get into the beta, but it really does look impressive. I mean, phenomenally impressive.
Well, they have said that it's coming to the consoles, but I haven't seen anything that said how the gameplay, you know, online gameplay is going to work.
Well, I know a reason those have been restricted in the past. I mean, like I said, I'm sure it's contractual, but since you don't have a keyboard on consoles, it's kind of hard to chat with people.
Right.
And those games rely a lot on, you know, chat windows.
But now everyone's doing voice.
That's true.
But in general, casually, people tend to shy away from the voice thing. Or at least that was my experience in Warcraft, where I think in a lot of the other Xbox games, I mean, you hear these horrible, horrible stories of these 11-year-olds swearing like sailors, spewing forth epithets to, you know, everyone and their mother, especially their mother. It's absolutely ridiculous. And so, you know, I can certainly see not wanting to encourage that as well.
Also, you know, your female character joins your group and the voice comes on and goes, "Hey, how you doing?" And you're like, "Wait a minute.
Don't.
You're the female wood elf Crystal?"
Yes.
Well, there's actually a flip side to that too, where girls go online without doing the chat part because they want to play on and be treated equal and not immediately have some 11-year-old tell them to get in the kitchen and make them a pie.
Right.
So yeah. There are a lot of girls that would, for them, it's a bad thing because it would, you know, immediately like give them away.
You know, you hear these horror stories of these women or girls even being incredibly harassed, just existing online. And it's just, I can't even fathom what that's like.
I was curious about that when I played EverQuest, and this is before, it's been like in 98, before there was any, you know, voice. I had played the game for about a year with male characters, and I'd heard about the harassment that women went under. So I made a female character, and within 10 minutes, I had experienced both the positive and the negative aspects of playing a female character. I had been given a complete set of handcrafted armor within 10 minutes of playing starting the character.
Yes, but that's called the white knight syndrome.
Yes.
Yes, they would, "Oh, honey, you're not wearing, oh, here's some stuff for you to put on." I'm like, "Thanks." But I'd also been hit on, had rude things said to me in, you know, whisper. And I was like, "Wow, this is incredibly annoying." And I ended up shutting off chat on that character.
You actually think that the vast majority of people playing female characters in the game are probably male anyway.
You would think that, but that's certainly not how my female character got
right.
treated.
Yeah, they're playing the odds, you know.
Right.
Like,
right.
One out of these five is going to be a girl.
It's just creepy.
I can only imagine it's worse with voice, though, because people just feel like they're anonymous, but they can say things that they would never write.
It's the John Gabriel's internet fuckwad theory. The internet gives a layer of quasi-anonymity, and so therefore they don't believe that there's any repercussion for their action. You know, so clearly they didn't play Fallout.
See, Tim, you've tried to make the world a better place.
It's funny, my mom watched my GDC talk video on YouTube. And she called me a few days ago and said, "Well, I see you have 169 likes, but you have one dislike. Who did that? Who's that person?" I was like, "I don't know." She goes, "Well, why would he dislike it? I want to know."
That person has been dispatched.
Well, I was like, I did not know how to explain to her that, you know, YouTube has how many hundreds of millions of people who look at it. And I don't know the one person who thumbed down the talk.
And the fact that YouTube is the worst cesspool of commenters.
The hive of scum and villainy.
Yes,
precisely. My idea is that we will know when society has evolved when they turn off comments on YouTube.
Ooh.
Yeah.
By the way, your GDC talk was awesome. I really, really enjoyed it.
The only problem I had with it was had nothing to do with you and had everything to do with the cameraman who couldn't figure out how to turn off autofocus.
Yes.
Holy crap.
Also, he probably should have looked at my slides more. Don't really need to see me.
You know, we talked a little bit about early video game influences, and I was wondering if you had any, like, favorite moments in video games.
There's an old game that's going to date me called Star Control 2.
Oh, yeah.
I absolutely adore that game. I love it. Even though I hadn't played it in, I don't know, 15 years, I still remember characters, some of the storylines, some of the funny events that would happen. And one of my favorite memories is there's this depressed race. I'm trying to remember what they were called. I don't think they were the Druge. But they wore masks over their face because they were so unhappy and depressed. And you find out it's because they lost something. And you find it for them and you bring it back to them. And they take off their masks of unhappiness and they put on their masks of joy, which look pretty much exactly the same. And I'm like, I'm so done helping you people.
But, yeah, like, no. You are not worth my help.
But the dialogue in that game is fantastic. It just, to me, it's a crystalline moment of perfect little game, perfect combat, perfect storyline, perfect dialogue, perfect pacing. I just love that game.
Nice.
For me, that's Grim Fandango.
Oh, wow.
Also a good game.
Fantastic. Well, a lot of the LucasArts games were just so well done. You know, there was
Sam and Max, yeah.
They recognized early on what was something we talked about earlier, is the importance of the writing.
Right. The story was all, yeah, it was all about, I mean, Monkey Island, you know, all
of
that
stuff.
Oh, my God. Oh, so much fun. I was, you know, hanging around YouTube and I came across someone who, like you do, and I came across someone.
Leaving comments.
I'm actually the one that's making all of those comments. All of them. All of them.
Why did you dislike my video?
Yeah.
It was an Aaron click. I couldn't take it away. I wound up watching someone play Monkey Island from start to finish.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
It was crazy. I want to say it was like an hour to do it all the way through entirely, you know, because normally when you're playing the game, you're trying to figure stuff out and you're going back and forth where you don't need to. This guy knew exactly what he needed to get done and he just ran through it. It was like a speed run.
It was
effectively a speed run.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think it was actually timed or anything like that, but it was effectively a speed run. And yeah, it was really wild because, you know, it just brought back all the memories of playing that game and all the scum VM type games. And
I saw a few years ago somebody posted a speed run for Fallout 1. They finished the entire game in 8 minutes.
Whoa. That is mind-boggling,
especially since we designed it to be 40 hours.
Yeah. So what was the trick? Because clearly he was able to sidestep a lot of the plots and all that.
Yeah.
So
well, I'm going to assume there's no spoiler warnings anymore.
No, it's a bit of an old game.
You're supposed to find the water chip.
Right.
Bring it back to your vault and then kill the master and kill his mutant army. Well, he skips the water chip entirely. We apparently never checked that to see if you did it before the game ends, because we assumed since it had, that was the initial quest line and there were originally timers on it, and you would just do it. So he runs straight to the master. I think he talks him into killing himself, which was possible.
Wow.
And then he runs to the military base where the mutants are and explodes a nuclear bomb under the base. And then he runs home. 8 minutes.
Oh, that is brilliant.
I'm sorry.
I love that.
Internet slow clap.
Yes. Wow. That is amazing. The whole concept of speedruns, they are so passionate about these games that they're playing that they want to do it as fast as they possibly can. And of course, then they want to show it off as well.
Yeah.
And that is so cool to see what these people have done with these games. You know, you have your Super Mario Brothers, and I guess one of the more famous speedruns, Metroid.
Yep.
You know, because the world was so vast, it took forever to play and all that. And it was such a fantastic game. It's one of my favorite games of all time. To be able to speedrun it, to blast through that in like 13 minutes or whatever it is, it's just like completely mind-blowing. Because I remember spending hours and hours and hours and hours and hours trying to figure all that stuff out and getting lost a lot as well. It's just absolutely mind-blowing. And the same thing with like Super Mario Brothers, and they'd warp from level to level, but they wouldn't necessarily, because, you know, when you played Super Mario Brothers and you first learned about the warp zones, you'd always warp to the highest level that you could possibly do. So you wind up warping to not the highest, but because of where you end up, you can then walk basically to the end bit. And that's, you know, how they would wind up doing it. And it's just amazing to see the techniques of other people, the very high end Street Fighter tournaments where you have these people who are just really, really into the game and they're super talented in the game and they play professionally against each other.
I love watching some of them for just a nostalgic reason.
I mean, I remember when I first saw Street Fighter 2, for example, my mind was completely blown. I don't know. There's something just about it that was really interesting to me, but it was so unlike any other fighting game like Fatal Fury or Final Fight, where it was a very linear, you know, you were dragged along sort of a weird plot and you were sort of forced to progress. This was a one-on-one fighting experience that had cool techniques that you had to discover, deciphering those, figuring all those out, because they weren't labeled on the game itself. Yeah. You had to figure that out by happenstance. And then suddenly your eyes get really wide and like, oh my God, did you see that? He just threw a fireball, you know, and that just, that was just absolutely amazing.
It was kind of like a 14-year-old Christopher who suddenly joined us.
Well, it's true. You know, I think, you know, you have to allow yourself to be wide-eyed now and again, because otherwise, you know, you wind up getting really cynical and you wind up getting frown lines, and that's not cool at all.
One of the guys I work with, he's half my age. He's 23. We were just talking, and one of the things that came up was how long I had been in the industry. And I told him that sometimes people ask me how I avoid burning out. There are a few people in the industry I know who are older than me, but most of them haven't been in the industry for 30 years. And I think part of it is just you can't take a lot of things so seriously. And you also just have to be accepting that everything's going to change. You know, I used to know chipset architecture on video cards really well because you had to code the chipset to do certain video modes. You don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
That's all, you know, and then DirectX came along, and, you know, BESA and all these different, you know, standards. And you just have to kind of roll with that and realize that those are just tools. Those are just a means to an end. But it's easy to burn out because I think people get very jaded and bitter, and, you know, a couple bad things will happen, and they just generalize that to the whole industry is terrible. And it's hard not to do that.
I just did an interview with the Fat Man. Do you remember the Fat Man?
Oh, yeah, George.
George Sanger.
Yes.
He kind of has that same sort of philosophy, you know, like, you know, things change and you've got to find your own, you know, happiness. You know, it's that, you know, roll with it and evolve and change kind of idea. Yeah, I think you would get along with him.
I think I met him once. Does he always wear like a cowboy suit?
Yes.
There we go. Yes. Yeah, easy to pick.
Eccentric and sweet and hilarious.
The only constant is change.
Yeah.
You know, certainly in the industry. And I think in a lot of industries, certainly where there's technology involved, which is pretty much every industry, right? If you're not open to new possibilities and doing things in a new way, you are very quickly going to be out of a job. Either the company that you're in doesn't pivot and doesn't move with the new technologies. You know, you don't change your personal skill set and you become redundant. And, you know, someone replaces you who is willing to learn new things and understand different ways of doing things.
Exactly. I think one of the things I've noticed, because I talk to the tech director at work sometimes, he found that newer programmers are more willing to try different solutions. Like older programmers tend to have this, here's my tool bag of things that I already know will work. So we found younger programmers will try different, sometimes crazy, sometimes amazing things. But at the same time, they go down more dead ends. So he said, if he needs something done in a certain way right now, he'll go to one of the more experienced programmers. But if he's not sure how something should be done, sometimes he throws it in the bullpen to the younger programmers that, you know, chew on this for a while and see if he can come up with a cool way of doing it.
Sure.
Which I also like is a nice way of viewing his stable of programmers.
It's nice because the younger programmers will be able to explore and they'll figure out different things, where the more senior programmers, they've amassed libraries that they've created themselves. Most programmers are lazy, you know, and I don't mean that in a derogatory fashion. I mean that, you know, they know that if they're going to need to do something more than once, they're going to create code that's reusable so that they don't have to code it again, you know,
and debugged.
Exactly. And so when they finally have a piece of, you know, a code fragment that is debugged and it does this thing that can be used in multiple instances, you're going to want to use that. And also, if you're senior or what have you, you've tried a bunch of stuff and have already failed.
Yes.
Whereas
many, many times.
Yeah. You know, and that's a huge part of it. Failure happens and you have to embrace that failure. You know, you have to realize that, oh, that thing that we spent so much time doing, well, it's a dead end. We've got to pivot and we've got to learn from that, certainly. But if it doesn't work, you have to understand that there's got to be a different way of doing it or a different avenue to pursue that you can still move forward.
That's one of the dangers I think the older programmers have is just because you have a really good hammer doesn't mean everything's going to be a nail. That's some of the things we've noticed is if you have these tools and you want to use one of those tools, even though they may not be 100% appropriate. But like I said, I think it's great. I actually like working with some of the younger guys because they have kind of like this, I want to say verve. I don't know what the word would be.
Yeah.
they're so excited. It's like, oh, well, we've got to, you know, do this really complicated thing here. Oh, I'm really excited. I want to do that. I want to try that. And you're like, oh, I've written 50,000 of those. I don't want to do that again. But yeah, they're really excited.
You were excited the first time too, though.
Oh, I was probably excited like the first dozen times. Yeah, after a while, you're like, if I write one more animation sequencer, you know, I'm going to die.
But that's the passion, right? I mean, that's really what it comes down to. You know, I would much rather have a passionate team that may not have the most experience, but has so much passion that they're willing to put in the extra effort to make it right, to make it the best thing that they can do, versus a cynical person who's going to bring the entire team down. Because it's a team effort. You can't, you know, nothing really exists in a vacuum these days. So unless you're very, very lucky, you know, chances are fairly good you're going to have to interact with other human beings. And it's so much better to have everyone super passionate about it and all towing the same line, because they all want to, not because they're forced to, because they'll get sacked if they don't. I guess it's what you experienced when you created Fallout in the first place. You know, people were staying late, unpaid, to work on your game because they thought it was cool.
Right. And that's the thing that, you know, you want to take advantage of people for that. But at the same time, almost everybody got in the computer game industry because they like computer games, not because they thought, oh, well, this is, you know, what my parents think I should be doing.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely one of the few industries that's like that. I mean, I think the film industry is like that to a degree. There are some people who get into it. It depends on which part you're in. But I think the video game industry is one of the very few industries that's is full of its fans as its workers as well. And it's kind of awesome. There's a couple of game houses here, and I have a couple of friends work here and there. And I really kind of envy that, you know.
If you're not passionate about what you're doing, you gotta figure out a way to do the thing that you're passionate about.
Well, that's always the advice I've given people when they say, you know, what kind of advice you can give me after doing this for so long? And I said, well, find the thing that you like doing and find the thing that you're good at doing. And if they intersect, you're golden. Because you got to find that Venn diagram intersection of what you're good at and what you like. Because if you don't like it, it doesn't matter how good you are. And if you... well, if you're not good at it, it doesn't matter how much you like it.
There's something to the idea that, you know, if you're not good at something, if you continue to practice at it and continue to learn more about it through doing or through research or what have you, you know, you'll get better at it. I keep forgetting the person who said this, but it takes roughly 10,000 hours to become competent at something. Mm-hmm. If you keep at it, you really will get better. You know, you may not be the best in the industry, you may not be whatever, but if you've got the passion and this is the thing that you want to do, keep doing it. I did want to talk to you about chocolate, because I think the idea of a website dedicated to all the chocolate you have consumed is epic.
And I started it. I have every label of every unique bar that I've eaten since 1992.
Wow. So what's
about
the
20 years.
What's the count on that?
Well, you know those really big scrapbook album? I have 6 of those filled with labels on about 2 labels per page, because I put the label and then I put a description of who gave it to me, what I thought of it, and the date. So that's why it's possible. I just started the web page a few months ago. I'm scanning all of these and putting them up on the web. And it's amazing how much I remember. Just seeing the label and reading that note, I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember that chocolate. It was really gross. You know, and then I write about it. But I also realize I've eaten so much chocolate. I've eaten tons, literally.
Well, literally tons? I was going to say, sure, you're not that big.
I used to buy 30-pound blocks of Ghirardelli dark chocolate.
What? And that's not the greatest of chocolates.
No, I would cook with them. I'd make stuff like chocolate chip cookies.
Oh, right on. Okay.
When I bought I bought them at Trader Joe's. They weren't that. When I bought my third block, the cashier who had seen me buy the other two in previous months, she just stopped and she goes, "Are you buying these for gifts?" I said, "No, I'm eating them."
Oh, no.
I was busted.
But, so you did the walk of shame. Oh, dear.
My shame and I sit in front of the television and eat the chocolate.
Yes.
There's or at least I thought it was a local company at the time. They actually had a physical presence in New York, and it's called Vosges. And they make, they're so good. Oh my God. It's ridiculously priced. It seems like every 6 months they raise the price of their bars an extra dollar, which is totally fucking insane. $10 for a bar of chocolate that's like, I think it's only a 250 gram bar. I could be wrong. I mean, that's ridiculous. But that said, they have something called their Fire Bar, which has chipotle chili in it. It's dark chocolate with the chipotle chili, and it's...
I've had that, and their bacon bar is really good, too.
I wasn't too keen on the bacon bar thing. I thought it was a little bit gimmicky. I like the salt aspect, but the smokiness, I thought, detracted, and the fact that it was milk chocolate, not dark chocolate.
They make a dark one now. Moe's dark bacon bar.
Oh, my God. I can't believe how much testosterone is in this conversation about chocolate.
Yeah.
Well, part of the reason I wanted to switch it to a webpage is the common question I get from my friends is, have you tried this bar yet?
Right.
And sometimes I don't remember.
Oh, sure.
You know, that said, we should probably mention your site, because if people are like me, when they're listening podcasts, they're also like, whoa, going to the website.
It's chocolateihavenown.wordpress.com. I post every day. So I posted every day since I started.
Wow.
At the current rate I'm going through my labels, I have 2 years of posts before I'll go through them all.
That's awesome.
Here's the other thing I was worried about. A lot of these chocolate bars were gifts. There was something, somebody traveled and said, hey, I found this bar in France, or I found this bar, you know, in Japan. And I would write down what I really thought of the bar.
As well you should.
So I actually called a friend of mine who'd given me a lot of chocolate, my friend Larry, and I said, are you okay with me saying, because you give me some great chocolate, but you've also given me some stinkers. And do you mind me saying that? He goes, no, go ahead. You got to be honest.
Yeah, exactly. You know, because not all chocolate is going to be good. And, you know, and it also doesn't detract. The fact that you didn't like the chocolate doesn't detract from the generosity of the gift giving and gift accepting.
Right.
It's not like they made the chocolate.
Although I am trying to get a friend of mine who works in an Antarctic research station.
What?
Who has access, he has a small plot in their greenhouse. Everybody gets a plot there. I wanted him to grow me some cacao and grind the beans there so I could have a chocolate bar from every continent.
Oh, that is
and he
awesome.
Isn't convinced yet, but I'm still working on it.
Yeah, no, I think if you hound him, he'll eventually have to submit, because that is too awesome.
I described the fermentation process that the cocoa beans have to go through, and I think I just lost them.
So could you, well, I'm trying to figure out, you know, based upon your own rules, if you sourced the beans from there, is that good enough, or does it have to actually become chocolate?
Now, I've noticed all these trends have been happening in chocolate, especially looking back at my books. Chocolate used to go, here's a chocolate bar, and maybe on the back they'd say where it was from. Mm-hmm. Then it started mentioning the country that made it. Then it started mentioning what percentage of cacao was in it. Now they actually say it's a single origin bar, and here's the country the beans are from.
Right. Yeah.
So like, you know, a Swiss company may make a bar, but they're actually saying these are, you know, Ecuadorian cocoa beans or Madagascar. Mm-hmm. So I could say, you could just have them send me the beans,
right,
and I could say they were grown in Antarctica.
Yeah.
Single origin Antarctic. That, cocoa bean.
That is so cool.
But I prefer if he made them as well.
Oh, sure, sure. Well, that also like saves the hassle of you making a chocolate bar out of it.
Well, plus I wanted him to make a label, because what I put in my book is a label.
Sure, yeah.
So I'd love for him to like just play with something, you know, and he's got a lot of free time. It gets very cold and there's not a lot to do there.
It's very cold. It's very lonely.
Amazingly, it's somebody I used to work with at Interplay, and that's what he does now is he spends, I think, 6 month tour duty or tour of or job or whatever.
Right.
At one of the Antarctic research stations.
Wow, that's amazing.
I've actually looked into it.
Oh, dear.
There's a very strange sort of person who's interested in that, and I've looked at jobs.
And you're a very strange person indeed.
I've looked for jobs like at McMurdo and places like that, and some of the projects at work, you know, they actually do go to the polls, and I've considered it.
You realize that...
Why would you want to do that?
I don't know. It's fascinating, I think. I would like to experience that sort of environment for an extended period.
Now, here's a question. You live in Southern California now. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Virginia.
Oh, that explains
just outside D.C. Yeah, I got a little bit of it. Most of the accent's gone by now.
It brings up a good point. Well, not necessarily a point, but an observation. Another interview I saw with you, you mentioned, you know, how having grown up where you did, right there at D.C., and the game being set there. One of the things I've seen, you know, is a lot of the Fallout fans, they're still very into the mythos that you guys have created. And of course, it's been expanded on with the subsequent games and stuff. But so much so that my friend Josh recently was going to D.C. for some reason. And being a huge Fallout fan, he didn't just go to D.C. He took his jumpsuit and he took his Pip-Boy. And while he was there, he took pictures, you know.
Brilliant. And of course, yep. there was the indie short film.
Nuka Break.
That was brilliant.
I got to meet the guys who made that. They're awesome. They're doing new ones now.
Oh, really? Oh, I've got to catch up with them. Wow.
They film it out here in, I think out in Death Valley or in some of the high deserts here. Because it looks perfect.
Yeah, of course, of course. The production values on that were amazing. Mm-hmm. They were really, really
great.
Well,
weapons and CG.
They really had the look down. I thought they did.
And they have a great sense of humor. I felt sorry for the guy wearing the ghoul mask out in the 110 degree heat for hours.
Yeah, that can't be good.
We got in a discussion about how I'm not for all the recent changes to copyright law that extended copyright.
Sure.
Because I think it's preventing stuff from going in the public domain that could then be picked up by creative people and expanded upon. I think that that's what it was intended for. Things are supposed to go into the public, you know, public culture. It's not supposed to be owned by a company. It's supposed to eventually go into our cultural heritage and we can do anything we want with it.
Absolutely.
I was hoping that would happen to anything I did.
Copyright is so broken and it's all due to Disney. You know, every time the mouse comes up, it gets extended another 20, 30, 40 years. And right. it's got to stop. You know, because
the mouse will be up again soon, by the way.
Right, so. which just means we're going to more copyright reform, and by reform we mean extension.
Right.
You know, Tim, precisely to your point, you know, that was the entire contract, right? You know, you get copyright, which means that you've got exclusive use and rights to that particular thing for a finite period of time, and then it gets released to the public. And when you prevent that from happening, we lose out. And
right. It hurts us.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's not just released into the public. The whole idea is by this time, it has become a part of society. Society has kind of dibs on it after a while. And of course, the flip side, you know, the people that are arguing against are saying, well, I made this thing, I should have it forever, and my company should have it in perpetuity. It's like, that's great, but that's not how the world works. You know, things right. become part of society. And if you look around at the things that are in our world, you know, it's like, oh, so Disney, you can't make The Little Mermaid because someone has copyright, you know.
I was going to say, most of their films are based on work in the public domain.
Exactly.
So there's a hefty bit of irony there, you know.
I'm particularly worried about games because as the platforms continue to be developed, games are becoming unplayable.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, because everything has changed.
And it's unfortunately worse on Mac than PC. Older PC games you can play often unchanged. And Windows was designed to be backwards compatible with each version. But a lot of times Mac, when they go from like, you know, one OS major revision to another, they just go, all this old code won't work. You just have to buy new stuff.
Right.
And that means the old ones just aren't playable anymore.
So we went through a bunch of transitions. We went from a 68K to a PowerPC transition. We've gone from a PowerPC transition to an Intel transition. But we've also gone from a classic system to a Unix-based system where there used to be a compatibility layer called Classic. And in newer versions of the operating system, that doesn't exist because the Classic was not actually an emulation layer. It was a virtual environment, and you needed to have a PowerPC chip in order to run it properly. All that stuff, like, remember the game Spectre or Spectre Supreme? You know, it was one of the first polygonal games. It was just wireframe, and you can't play the original game anymore because, right. you know, A, you don't even have floppy disks, right? And even if you did have the original floppy disks and you could find a floppy drive in order to put it into your Mac, chances are fairly good those floppies have bit rotted. You can't even transfer from older hard drives to newer hard drives or from zip disks or even from optical media from 10 years ago.
And that's what the consoles, I mean, PS2 used to have a ability to play PS1 games. When the PS3 first came out, they said you could play PS2 games, but that went away, mm-hmm. and now it's just the case where when new consoles come out, the old games just become unplayable. And they recently ran into that problem. The Smithsonian Institution has a game exhibit right now, computer game exhibit.
Yeah.
And just finding the hardware needed to run some of the games was very difficult.
Because you figure at least Sony would probably have some PS1s lying around, but I guess they all get eventually offed.
Yeah, I've heard of publishers coming back and asking developers for code because they've lost it after 5, 10, 15 years.
Oof.
And it's just nobody's thinking of long-term archival storage of these games, either keeping the original code and assets around so they can be rebuilt for a modern operating system to run, or just keeping around hardware, the specialized hardware you need to run. So the stuff is probably going to be lost.
When you're dealing with saving ones and zeros to a ferromagnetic substrate, that's volatile. You know, it's not like celluloid film being put in a salt mine, you know, where chances are fairly good it'll last you 100 years. You know, it's entirely possible that the half-life of a particular, no pun intended, the half-life of a video game code base is maybe 5 years. You know, simply because of the advancements in hardware and the advancements in operating systems, hard drives die. They have an MTBF of, you know, 100,000 hours or so. If you just keep them on the shelf, something may go wrong. If you don't keep them on the shelf and you keep them actively running, something may go wrong eventually. Physics happens. So we've got friction, we've got gravity, we've got all sorts of fun things. You really do have to think about how on earth you're going to keep these things alive.
Well, I think to Tim's point is there really aren't a lot of people doing that. Like, you know, the film industry, it's part and parcel of their business to do that for film. I mean, other than the Smithsonian and maybe a few other projects, and then people who are more obsessive over that sort of thing are doing it. But I don't think, and Tim, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think there's any sort of industry, I don't think it's normal for in the gaming industry to say, oh, we're going to archive our code in such a way as to, you know, keep it forever.
They don't do that. And also what frequently happens is when you're finished doing a project for hire, the publisher asks you for copies. And sometimes you're not supposed to keep a copy.
Right, because it's a work for hire.
For NDA reasons.
Right.
Yeah, you don't own the rights to it. So, you know, after you give us all the copies and we confirm we have them, you're supposed to destroy them. Well, so if that publisher loses them or bit rot happens to those DVDs, they're gone. And I'm just worried that, you know, how many apps are in the App Store? Who's archiving these? What's going to happen to these games, the source code and source assets for all these games in 5, 10, 20, 30, 40 years? It's just going
to
be gone.
Sure. Yeah, because I used to save everything. Over time, not everything gets transferred to new hard drives. And I've got, you know, hard drives in my closet. They've got code samples from a jillion years ago when I actually programmed for a living. I haven't even tried to, I mean, they're all SCSI or ATA.
Oh, I hate you right now. Because I'm thinking of that same box in my closet going, oh God, yeah. I really should.
There's all that stuff there that, you know, and I'm actually looking at an external SCSI 1, mind you, you know, 5 megabyte per second SCSI 1, a 4X CD burner in my little cabinet here. I have no way of hooking that into anything. I simply do not own the hardware that will allow me to hook it up into anything.
Right. And it's a lot harder to even know what to archive, because for a game, you probably want to archive all the original 3D art models, animations, but those are often tied to a particular piece of software. Maybe they made them with 3D Studio. Maybe they made them with, you know,
Maya
Alias.
Or right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Maya. And then you have to know what version, because maybe it won't work. I mean, they come out with a new version of Lightwave and this stuff doesn't work with the old stuff doesn't work. And so you have to store not only the assets, but also all the tools used to make them and the process by which the tools made them.
Wow, it's really depressing.
Yeah, I just am worried that games are going to be lost. You know, we'll be talking about games in 20 or 30 years that we only remember that just can't be played.
Right. And we'll just see crappy screen grab YouTubes, you know, of them. That's one way of archiving these films. If I recall correctly, there are a few websites out there that are dedicated to trying to save them, but they're very, or at least when I last checked them, they were very amateur and they didn't seem to quite have all of their shit together. It's a wonderful idea, but I think it's one of those things where more people need to be conscious of it so that they can support these guys who are trying to, you know, to trying to really save history.
Those guys, I mean, they're amateurs because that's such a legally gray area.
Well, right.
No one can really get involved. Who can put any risk into it?
All they want to do is keep history alive. The concept is fairly straightforward. Take the entire build chain and all the assets and stick it on a hard drive. Every year or so, copy that to something else. When you really get down to it, you almost have to save actual hardware as well. But then you can't just save one of those, because if that breaks down, then you're completely boned.
Just personally, I try to back up my stuff to DVD and to an external hard drive. But when I moved the last time, I think I may have lost some of the DVDs.
Ooh.
I can't find them. And if something happened to the external hard drive, well, I'm kind of, that's, I'm in a bad state. So I'm trying to bring some things back onto my machine, burn out some more DVDs. But I don't know. It's hard to figure out what way of storing things are going to actually preserve something in the future.
Right. So, Tim, thank you very much for coming and having a chat with us. It's been enlightening and engaging and fun.
Well, thank you both very much. I had a wonderful time.
You're very, very welcome. So where can we find you?
I'm currently working at Obsidian Entertainment. I just really like, they make role-playing games. They're a wonderful fit for the kind of games I like making.
Any social network that you want to gain a whole bunch of followers?
But I think my chocolate WordPress blog is where I'm directing most people right now.
So again, that URL is chocolateihaveknown.wordpress.com, and we'll have that in the show notes as well. So Maggie, how about you?
As always, you can find me on Twitter at TANKGRRL or at about.me/Maggie McPhee. And where can we find you, sir?
You can find me on the Twitters as well at Octothorpe, OCTOTHORPE, or you can find me on my still incredibly neglected personal blog at localtype.org.
That was another episode of Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod. You can find us at ruiningitforeveryone.tv or search for Ruining It for Everyone on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe and rate the show, as it really helps us out.
Wait, this isn't the Tim Kaine who sings I'm a Duck?
No, sorry.
Oh, crap. I prepped for the wrong show.
Don't. That's next week. That's next week.
Tim, my kids love your music.
That guy must hate that when someone Googles me, they come up with his site first.